Welcome to another edition of Sheer Intelligence, where the intelligence comes from my guest, in this case, Richard Reeves, arguably one of the great American journalists of the whole last 40 years or so, worked for the New York Times and New York Magazine, every which publication, wrote a bunch of great books on the American presidency about Ronald Reagan, about Richard Nixon, about Jack Kennedy. And the most recent book is a book called Infamy, The Shocking Story of the Japanese-American Internment in World War II, when 120,000 Japanese-Americans, 70% of whom were citizens, were rounded up, no charges ever brought against them, no crime ever committed. And the reason that's in the news now, and one reason I wanted to talk to Richard Reeves, who teaches at the Annenberg School, where I also teach, of communication journalism at USC, from where we're broadcasting, was that this Japanese internment camp has surfaced now with President-elect Trump as a kind of model of what we can do to Muslims and other undesirables. And maybe we should just begin by discussing this. You've covered not only presidents, you actually covered Donald Trump at one point. You know a great deal about this. How much trouble are we in? And, you know, to cite Sinclair Lewis, the great American writer, who wrote a book, It Can't Happen Here. He was being sarcastic. He was afraid it would. Can it happen here, meaning fascism?
That's why I wrote the book, because I had the sense that immigrants or border crossers or particularly Muslims might get rounded up the same way they did to the Japanese in 1942. The country got hysterical. The press was hysterical. The public officials from Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who ordered it, to Earl Warren, who really was the driving force behind it.
The governor of California.
Yeah, the great governor of California.
The great liberal Supreme Court justice.
Well, there's no, you know, the Supreme Court plays a role in this story and this book, but there's no doubt in my mind that Earl Warren, who was a, you know, man of religion and all that, regretted his life. And there's no doubt to me, too, that that's what led to the Brown versus Topeka Board of Education. Here in California, they do huge oral histories on governors. The one with Earl Warren lasted for 6 days. A woman named Amy Fry did the interviewing, and on the sixth day, she said, Mr. Chief Justice, I'd like to ask you about the events of the spring of 1942. Warren stood up, broke into tears, walked out, and never came back. So he knew.
That was the end of the interview.
That was the end of the interview. But he wasn't alone. I mean, the most vicious cartoons about the whole thing, which were posted all over the West, were by the cartoonist who one day would be known as Dr. Seuss. Edward R. Murrow said that the Japanese were coming to destroy the West Coast, and they'd be wearing University of Washington sweatshirts when they got here to drop the bombs.
So we had hysteria coming out of the mouths of liberal people. By the way, just as a footnote, when I was writing about the origins of the Vietnam War, I went to interview another great liberal justice, Supreme Court Justice William Douglas. And Douglas had been involved in something called the Friends of Vietnam, helping to install Ngo Dinh Diem in power in Vietnam, and I believe came to regret that very much.
I'm sure he regretted his vote on the camps, too. He not only voted for them, but he was the player who had the most to do with the fact that Roosevelt did not want this to come up before the 1944 election, because by then he knew it was a disaster, and enough Americans did, but not enough to make it a campaign issue unless the courts took action. So the Justice Department fabricated evidence, and the justice voted, not unanimously, 7-2 this time, that it was constitutional, which means we could do it tomorrow.
But I want to underscore the racism of this, because it applies to the Muslims and Mexican-American immigrants and so forth. It happens, I am, as a result of birth, my father was a German-American Protestant, and my mother was a Russian Jew, and my father had come over from Germany at the time of the First World War. But we had a lot of relatives in Yorkville and everywhere in New York, and German Americans were the largest immigrant group in the United States, and I think still are, but they definitely were.
Ancestry group in the United States.
Okay, so my Landsmen, at least half of my Landsmen, were these German Americans. And not only were they not rounded up, and we actually had a relative who was in one of those subs that were captured off Long Island. And I remember my uncle and father going to, you know, check them out at the camp or something. But, you know, short of that, German Americans were welcomed into the U.S. Armed Forces to fight in the European theater. And my half-brother, Arnold, was in the American Army Air Force and bombed our hometown in Germany, and no one questioned his loyalty, nor should they have. But the German-American population was not treated to any of the kind of discrimination.
Forget the German-Americans.
And Italian-American, by the way.
The Germans. We took an awful lot of prisoners, German prisoners of war around the country, usually in Texas, Southwest. They were white, the Germans. They were allowed to walk, to work in the towns. They were allowed to go shopping. They were allowed to go to the movies with white girls, as long as they were white. These were German soldiers.
Yeah.
And many of them are still here because they married local girls. There were no local American men around. We were overseas fighting their brothers, but they were white. And the Japanese, in the famous words of the general of the Fourth Army, John Dwight, who was also part of initiating the camps, said, "A Jap's a Jap. You can't tell the difference between them, so we got to lock them all up."
So I really want to begin with thinking about, what does this election mean for this country? Are we opening the door to a kind of fascism? Is this jingoism alive? And there are comparisons. People say, no, he's just like Ronald Reagan. Well, you wrote...
He's not at all like Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, you profiled Reagan. And, well, first of all, tell us...
I spent 6 years with Reagan working on that book. No, Ronald Reagan was no Donald Trump, thank goodness. And whatever we think, I mean, as you know, we both followed him pretty closely.
Yeah.
Ronald Reagan was no dope. He knew what he thought. He knew what he could get away with and what he couldn't. With Trump, we're into uncharted waters, or uncharted Trump water.
So let me get your assessment of where we are in terms of Donald Trump. And it does relate to your book, because we have somebody who's bashing the other, bashing immigrants, bashing people for their religion, as well as their ethnicity and race. And you know Trump. You've covered him as a journalist. I'm talking to Richard Reeves, who's famous for writing for the New York Times and for New York Magazine and just about every other magazine.
It pays, yes.
So, yeah, you've been around for half a century profiling people. How'd you first meet Trump?
I first met Trump in 1980. I won the Emmy. I had done a film for ABC called Lights, Cameras, Politics, and it won the documentary Emmy for that year, and the ceremony was in New York. The cardinal, I've forgotten his last name, but the cardinal was very close to the New York newspaper community, and he was giving out the awards. But then suddenly he says, "We have a special guest here who is going to present the award." And this guy, 32 years old, with scraggly yellow hair, came out, shook my hand.
Naturally
said,
yellow?
What?
Was it naturally yellow?
When he was a boy. He was a boy. Although he still is a boy, and that's a goddamn problem. But Donald Trump handed me that Emmy, and I had no idea who he was. But then over the years, writing about wealth, really, wealth in America and how it's divided, I did a long series of interviews with him. You have to do a long series because the man has obvious problems with attention span, so that you've got to ask the same thing over and over again. And his language, which the American something or other society has pegged at fourth grade level, he doesn't finish sentences. He is hyperactive. He's a hyperactive kid who's lived in a bubble for his whole life and has no idea about like the irony that people who voted for him think he relates to their lives. He's been above their lives 100,000 feet in his private jet, flying over Youngstown or wherever. But I think the danger is incredible because the man, like a child, is unpredictable. I mean, his rhetoric, that isn't fair. He said it first. I didn't say it. I didn't do it. It was him. Exactly. We both raised sons, right? Exactly the way 12-year-old boys work if you yell at them to stop burning down the house.
So, but let's go back at that moment when you interviewed him. How old was he then? And
first time when I started that series, it was for a special issue of Money Magazine, for their 30th or something anniversary. He was in his early 50s. He spent the first time I saw him, he spent most of the time showing me. He's got memorabilia all around.
Is this
around.
At his office? Or
in his office, yeah, in the tower. And all this memorabilia is around, like a 12-year-old's room. He says, wait till you see what I have now. And he walked over, he came back with a a sneaker about the size of a rowboat. And he said, Shaquille O'Neal gave me his shoe. And then as you interviewed him, every 10 minutes, this was long before politics, every 10 minutes, a secretary would come in with a small pile of clips and AP machine material. She came in every 15 minutes, every day, and if his name was mentioned, and she was the Google search of her time. Whenever his name was mentioned, it came in. He would stop whatever he was doing, go back to his desk, and read them all. Say, look at this. Look what they said about me in the New York Post today. So it was like bringing up a 12-year-old. And I think he's as unpredictable and as ignorant as most 12-year-olds.
You know, I want to get more on that, but Chris Hedges wrote an article for Truthdig, which I happened to edit today. And I read it this morning, and it really frightened me. Now, some people say Chris can be over the top or he can be, but it really alarmed me because he began by saying there will be a crisis. Could be some war gone wrong or planes going into the World Trade Center or a riot in some city or the economy going into a tailspin. And this crowd, and he had a pretty broad view of this crowd. He seems that Trump really sort of represents the front man for a lot that's scary in America, a lot of irrationality and failed hopes and so forth. And he said, our layer of protections is going to be shredded in no time.
Against what?
Our civil liberties protections. Yeah. And the very thing we're here to talk about, your book, Infamy, and the rounding up of the incarceration of the Japanese. And already you're getting out of the Trump camp people saying, well, we have a model here in the Japanese internment camps. And that you could see, I remember I worked on a movie called The Siege with Denzel Washington, and I was on with Ariane Huffington and Matt Miller. We did it, a left, right, and center thing.
Well, I remember I was a young boy listening to
and I said, in that movie, I was against rounding up all the Muslims in Brooklyn, and I think Ariana favored it. I don't know if that was a role she was playing, I'm sure.
Well, she was then Gingrich's consort.
Right, but I'm sure she was just playing a role she wouldn't defend now. But that wasn't my point. The point is, that seemed improbable. Then a year later, 9/11 happened after the movie came out, and suddenly a lot of things seemed possible. But now with Trump, how frightened are you that there could be that moment? And you don't have an FDR or even an Earl Warren making these decisions. You've got Donald Trump, who you probably have had as much exposure to as anyone in terms of that kind of long—
including his wives, yeah.
—and long interview.
No, I think it will happen. I agree totally with Chris. I mean, I think I know something about being president, and it is the job, despite what people think, is really reactionary. We judge our presidents by how they reacted to events unforeseen. And as Kennedy had 13 days in the Cuban Missile Crisis, it's going to be 13 seconds or minutes this time with a man who thinks life is lived as a tweet. And I think he's capable of anything. And if there aren't people there to stop him, I mean, we remember him both fondly and badly, but Alexander Haig had given orders to the Pentagon, which they accepted, that they were to call him back before they took any order from Nixon, when Nixon was going around the bend and at the end of his tenure. The problem is there anybody but Ivanka who can stop him from doing the first thing that comes into his mind?
This is Sheer Intelligence. My guest is Richard Rees. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Sheer Intelligence. My guest is Richard Rees, the author of Infamy, the shocking story of the Japanese-American internment in World War II. How did we get to this point? How did this happen? How did irresponsibility become the order of the day? And one question I would connect to that is, why do we still invest the power in the president to wipe out all life on this planet based on, what did Hillary Clinton say? You have 40 minutes or 4 minutes.
Right.
4 minutes to decide.
Right.
Why haven't we, with the end of the Cold War, with the end of MAD, Mutual Assured Destruction, and hair trigger alerts, why haven't we done anything to control the power of the president?
Well, in his briefings, President-elect Trump, a basic question has been, we've got all these nuclear weapons. Why don't we use them? You know, why do we let people say bad things about us when we have the power to wipe them out? So that, you know, we're at the edge, and there doesn't appear to be any mitigation between him and the extraordinary power that a president has, particularly where nuclear weapons are concerned. I mean, my own feeling is that this guy, in terms of temperament and experience, could run a country. Unfortunately, the country is North Korea. We are in real trouble. And a man who doesn't listen, he is totally ignorant about most of the things that will suddenly start crossing his desk. Even in his first memoir, The Art of the Deal, the third paragraph described how he worked. He said, I go into the office, I read the New York Times, I read the New York Post. Now he's attacking them. And then I sit and wait for the phone to ring, and whatever happens, there I am. Well, the presidency is not at all like that. Yes, the red telephone may ring, but it's not what the only part of the job.
So let me ask you, as a major scholar on the presidency, which you are, what is it that has brought us to this point? Because it can't all be the charisma and wealth of Donald Trump. There was a collapse of power on both sides.
Right. And started a long time ago.
And there's a lot of anger out there.
We have dumbed down America to the point. I mentioned that analysts have shown that Trump speaks at a fourth grade level. George Washington's farewell address, written by Alexander Hamilton, is graded at a first year graduate student level, the words used and not used. And then we went through the great communicator, our friend Ronald Reagan. What made him the great communicator was he could take incredibly complex things, dangerous things, and put them into simple words that could be understood. That's a remarkable skill, depending on how it's used. And Trump, I mean, what Reagan really did was dumb down America. And now America, with the fractionation of information and whatnot, is pretty close to the bouncing off the bottom. We have a president who speaks as if he's in the fourth grade, and there are millions of people who don't mind that. It's not that they believe him. It's that he's a metaphor for their own thinking.
You say Hamilton wrote the farewell address for George Washington, but the ideas were consistent with ones that Washington valued.
Oh, yeah.
And part of that had come out of his experience being a general and leading the nation in war. And there's a message in that farewell address. Unfortunately, very few people ever seem to read it. It's a farewell address that I believe was written before he began his second term.
Right.
He kept it in his desk. He showed it to people. And so he thought a lot about that farewell address. And there's a phrase in there. He warns us against the impostures of pretended patriotism. And he seemed to have a genuine concern about power corrupting and a concern for limited government. And, you know, he said, use gentle means, yes, commerce, yes, trade, force nothing, et cetera. Now, of course, they did force within the American continent, but there was a real sentence that the best of us will go wrong, will go south, will misbehave. With Trump, one has none of that. There's this absolute confidence that your every whim is wise. And what is shocking is the American public, in large measure, seems to know he has this failing, yet they voted for him. And one argument is that there's a large number of people, working class, lower middle class, white people in particular, who feel desperate about their circumstance, and they took this roll of the dice.
Right.
And don't we have sort of a bipartisan responsibility for this desperation, as well as hyping the foreign dangers, the need for a big military machine, the endless wars?
Well, I mean, we do, but unfortunately, this is not going to be a bipartisan administration in the White House, in the Congress. I think, the better angels of our nature, as Lincoln said, are really reflected in the fact in that meeting with Obama, where Obama obviously scared the hell out of him about what the power was. But Obama is saying all the right things. Hillary Clinton has said all the right things. We're all in this together, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think that will penetrate the hairline of our new president. As far as anyone can tell, he doesn't listen to anybody. And the tweeting is so kind of symbolic because he's sitting there alone in this gold ivory tower saying the most inflammatory things to 13 million people, I think is his latest following. And a lot of them believe it.
Okay, but you're still begging the question.
Is there a way to stop him?
Well, no.
You know, we're journalism professors. I tell my students, you know, these people are trying to destroy the press, and we've got to fight back. And we have the last line of defense, and there are only half as many of us as there were 10 years ago.
You know, I teach on the other wing of the Annenberg School of Communications and Journalism. So as a communications professor, I wonder what's happened to our system in this day and age. And we are recording here in the Les Moonves, what do you call it?
Les Moonves Studio? I don't know what they call it.
Yeah, we are the center here of teaching, and we have great students here learning radio and television broadcast and print and so forth. But Les Moonves, the head of CBS, is someone who said it is bad for the country, or may be bad for the country, but Donald Trump is great for CBS. Bring it on.
Right.
The profits were rolling in and so forth. So, you can't just say there's this accident of some brilliant, dangerous demagogue who came on the stage. There are other folks, other interests, other motivations for bringing him to the stage and making him a success. He's a product of American culture at this moment, and of American capitalism, actually.
And, of course, we, Les Moonves more than most, we were the press, the media, whatever we're calling it these days, was his initial constituency. And he was great fun. He sold papers, as they say, and helped CBS because, of course, none of us thought for a second this man could win an election for president of the United States. By the time we woke up to the reality of the country at this moment, we then began to take a look at the sleazebag, crook, thief, liar.
You're speaking about the president of the United States.
He's not president yet.
Yeah.
He's not president yet.
Well, hopefully this evergreen show will prove you wrong, and he'll be a great enlightened leader.
God,
but
I hope
go
it's
on.
Short. And then it was only then, when he got the nomination, and even after that, that we began to really treat him anything like an ordinary candidate. There were things in his background that we should have gone after him in January of the year, not in July or August. We let him get away with murder. We quoted everything he said. I mean, we bear a lot of if it's guilt or whatever the word is, for this happening. We did not treat the presidential election as anything other than an entertainment.
I'm asking you, how did we get the imperial presidency, even though our first president, George Washington, warned us about the imperial presidency? We have separation of powers, we have checks and balances, we have the Bill of Rights, and yet somehow year after year, we have become the thing that another great general turned president, Eisenhower, warned against because of the military-industrial complex. We're on permanent war footing. And the great danger, really, the great danger is invoking an enemy, saying we have an enemy. He's great at trafficking in enemies, right? And then you have to round up, as they did in World War II, you have to round up groups of people who you say are the enemy. In this case, he's already started talking about rounding up Muslims and Mexican-Americans and who knows who else is on risk. How did we get to this place?
We got old. The people who voted for Trump, by and large, were old white men like us. And their real complaint is they're not going to be young again. And they are willing to take down a lot of people. Going this state, the Prop 13, when old people couldn't handle their taxes, and that was a revolution in itself, the end of property tax, as it were, in California. But these people are now looking around, seeing a different country. They don't like the strangers. They had a black president, a great president, I think history will record, and they couldn't bear that. They couldn't bear it, and they were willing to do anything for the pleasure of the week or months that they're going to feel good about this, because the man's going to fail and may take us down with him.
One way, Leonard Cohen, we used to say, the late Leonard Cohen, there's a crack in everything, that's how the light gets through. There are contradictions. And one contradiction we see, you mentioned Prop 13, and yes, California has gone a lot of different ways, gave the country Ronald Reagan, gave it to Earl Warren, and so forth. But California now is the great exception in the United States. Not only deep blue, but deep progressive blue. You know, just elected a black woman to the Senate, and a very liberal one. And California did not go the way of the nation, and has rejected that kind of extreme conservatism. And the key is California has embraced its immigrant population. It rejected 187, that infamous proposition that would have really singled out. The courts
Californians are not ignorant about immigration, because we see it work all around us. But in the rest of the country, they can be told it's an invasion, and that's the reason they don't have jobs. California is what it is because it was not in the Rust Belt. These poor folks in what they call flyover country lost their raison d'etre. They had no reason to exist anymore. It must hurt like hell. California, on the other hand, not only has the temperate climate, but it has Silicon Valley. It has immigrants who work harder and harder and harder. That's why we're so different from the rest of the country at the moment.
You know, last word from you, and then we're going to tie this up. But I've known you for many years. We've competed on some stories. We've disagreed on a few things. But it's been quite a journey. And now we're two old guys hunkered down here at the University of California. And as long as the football team does well, I guess we'll survive. And I have to ask you, though, did you ever think it would come to this? I think of all of the... I mean, you look back now, and even Richard Nixon looks good by comparison. I mean, he had a brain, he had experience. Ronald Reagan looks temperate by comparison. You know, and you really wonder. And yes, we were happy to be in California because we have sane leadership in the state. But you have to really wonder. I opened and started this morning very early, as I said before, reading Chris Hedges and Truth Dig, and getting enormously depressed and thinking, you know, it can happen here. Sinclair Lewis, the way we began this interview, fascism.
Yeah.
It can happen here. You wrote a book about our flirtation with concentration camps, infamy, the rounding up and imprisonment of Japanese Americans, a very important book. And then I think here we are sitting in our, not quite our dotage,
right,
but two guys who've seen a lot. And did you ever think we'd be here talking about American fascism? I think that's what we're talking about, the possibility of people being rounded up. First come for the Muslims, they're coming for the right. two of us at some point,
yep.
right? How would you, what is your despair? What is your hope at the moment? What is your, where do you think we are?
Well, I think we're in a world remade by technology, by globalization. We thrived and thrived, particularly in the 50s and the 60s, because we were the only economy in the world. Now, we're not the only economy, but we still think everybody wants to be like us. They don't want to be like us. There are things about us they don't like. They want what we have, and they are now getting it because of new technologies, and those new technologies that have allowed someone to build a network of sorts in China is the same globalization to put those people in Youngstown on the street. And there's nothing can be done about that.
A lot can be done. It's called share the wealth, Richard. Maybe it's something you and I have disagreed on. But
no, I'm all for sharing the wealth.
The old New Deal idea was, you know, you better share it. I remember
all in this together.
We're all in this together, and it means not just, you know, smiling at each other, the Hillary message, but rather share that wealth and don't let Wall Street grab it would be my little editorial comment. Well, that does it for Share Intelligence. My guest has been Richard Reeves, the author of Infamy, a terrifically important book on the rounding up of Japanese American citizens and a terrible warning of what could be happening now to our country. Our producers have been Rebecca Mooney and Josh Scheer. Our engineers at KCRW are Kat Yor and Mario Diaz. And here at USC, Sebastian Grubar has been our brilliant engineer. See you next week.